This program is brought to you by Joule, sous vide by Chef Steps. Joule takes the guesswork out of cooking. Learn more at chefsteps.com/joule.
Communications Director Kat Johnson with a preview of this week's episode of Meat in Three.
I think we should realize that we more or less have a broken food system. When 800 million of us go to bed hungry, 600 million are obese, we waste 30% of our food, then something is fundamentally wrong.
We'll introduce you to one food waste solution happening in Asia.
They introduced a system where residents were issued an electronic ID card that would open an automated bin and enable them to weigh the food waste being dropped off. And then they would be charged, you know, in a certain amount of money for the weight of that food.
And we'll take a look at some of the real struggles happening closer to home.
How is it possible that a meal that was perfectly fine to consume at 10:59 p.m. then becomes waste at 11 p.m.
So tune in to this week's Meat in Three on Heritage Radio Network, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to In the Drink on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, back to talk about all things beverage. As you guys probably know, if you listen to the show, when I'm not hosting In the Drink, you can find me at Fausto, where I'm the beverage director and co-owner, along with Chef Aaron Chambura. And I'm also a little bit of a partner in a restaurant called Celestine, which is a beautiful restaurant down in Dumbo right on the water. So come visit one of these two places. I'm really excited about today's show. We have on a great producer, I would say an iconic producer out of Sicily, from the Benanti Winery. Benanti has been on my list at Fausto since day one, the Pietra Marina, and we've poured for some time the Etna Rosso by the glass. Pietra Marina is widely considered, and I agree with those who think this, to be one of Italy's great white wines. Throughout their whole lineup, you find wines that have elegance, purity, minerality. They're just some of the prettiest wines on the island of Sicily. And I'm so excited to have Antonio Benanti here in the studio with us today to talk about the Benanti Winery and what you guys have going on at this really interesting time for your family winery as well. So welcome to In the Drink. It's great to have you here.
Thank you, Joe. I'm very happy to be here.
So can you give us a short synopsis of the history and how we are here today with you and your brother taking over the winery?
Sure. We as a family have been producers of wine on Etna for a number of generations. So we are locals. We are not investors on Etna. We are actually locals. We are from there, from Etna, born in Catania, and we grew up there. Our ancestors were making wine like many others on the island because Etna has a deeply rooted culture of making wine. But for many generations, it has been fairly not really aiming very high. The region was not really aiming at bottling and aging fine wine. Then my father changed things. This is what the kind of credit he gets for changing things and the course of, I would say, the destiny of Etna 30 years ago. And by being a pioneer of fine winemaking. And 6 years ago, my twin brother Salvino and myself, we decided to make this our lifetime project. So we took over and we brought about a few what I think are improvements. And New York and the US is our main export market, so we come here a lot. And so in a nutshell, this is how we are here.
And when your father had this idea in the 1980s to create a high-quality wine on Mount Etna, from what I understand, there was literally no one else had that idea at that time. That was truly a visionary of his.
I would say that there were very few examples. One of them is Barone di Villa Grande, for example, mm-hmm. That has been making wine on Etna since 1727. I think what my father brought really is a different ambition, and I think a very professional and very ambitious way of making wine. fostering the indigenous varieties of Mount Etna. So yes, he was a first mover. He was a pioneer. His approach was disruptive in a good way. And he, our first harvest was 1988. There were maybe three or four producers then on Mount Etna. Now we have 160-ish because they keep changing every month. And yes, I think he was the first one that was able to really produce fine, elegant, bottled, age-worthy Etna wine. So we are very proud of that.
And how did he go about doing that? Because he wasn't in the wine business before, so he had some help, right?
Yes. My father has always loved wine. He has traveled a lot in his other job as in the pharmaceutical industry, but he had memories of harvest with his grandfather. My grandfather died in the 50s, his grandfather, and then my grandfather discontinued the production of wine at the amateurial level we had at that time. So my father really started again from scratch, but again, he knew about vineyards, he knew about the very high suitability and quality of Etna as a region. But of course, he's not a winemaker, he's not an enologist, he's a chemist, he's a pharmacist. So he sought the advice of a young local enologist and also professionals from world-class wine regions like Lange, so Piedmont and Burgundy in France, to get that kind of mentality. So it was a mix of local knowledge, local territory, knowledge of the vineyards, and this help from professionals helped to bridge the gap between that and the kind of wine he had in mind.
It's so interesting that he sought the help of people from Lange and Burgundy, because so often you hear people compare the wines of Mount Etna, the reds especially, to the elegant reds of Piedmont and Burgundy. I wonder what it was. I wonder if you know what it was that he saw in Etna that sort of immediately brought him to think of those places to seek for advice.
Well, for the kind of wine that one can make on Etna, for sure those two regions are the benchmarks. Mm-hmm. The very Etna wine itself, the Nerello Mascalese-based wine, does have some similarities with those with the Pinot Noir and the Nebbiolo-based wines. And also, the diversity of Etna and sort of patchwork of very different terroirs that, again, has very, very few proxies in the wine world. And for sure, Lange and Burgundy had already demonstrated this diversity and the uniqueness of very small parcels. So I think he was again the best examples to whom he could refer to. But these days we never proactively mention those territories, because what we really care about is to, of course, foster and talk about the Etna identity. But then, of course, it's nice when the others at the other end spontaneously do bring up those comparisons with places like Burgundy and Lange, which are for sure the benchmarks of reds for that style of reds.
Maybe one day people will say that, oh, this wine is really good. It's like Etna Rosso.
It's happening. It's already happening sometimes. So it's no longer the embryonic stage of Etna. I think by now, especially professionals like you and in the very developed wine markets and wine cities, I think at times Etna is used as a reference. So we're very happy, because if I think of how it was 30 years back, it's very different now. It's still niche. There's still a barrier to overcome. A lot of people don't know the grape varieties, and it always takes a little bit of time to first talk about the territory. And people inevitably always try to find out what other grapes the Etna ones taste like. It's an inevitable process. But then I think in a few years, Etna will be really well known, and it will become a benchmark itself.
And you know, I feel confident in saying that a large part of the interest for Etna is the work that your father and your family has done. Were there some benchmarks? Were there some times where you saw the interest in the region speed up? Because to go from 3 or 4 producers to 160 is quite a multiple.
Yes, I think we have to give credit. There were, I think, 3 main, shall we say, waves in the growth of number of producers. Our winery has been almost alone and almost by itself for 10 to even up to 13 years. Then in the early 2000s, producers that had a very clear idea of how to make wine on Etna, market Etna wine, like Terre Nere, like Franchetti, so Passo Pisciaro, and also Frank Cornelissen, they came to Etna, so the number of producers, quality-oriented producers that were talking about Etna indigenous grapes increased. So I think for sure that year, I'm talking about 2001, so that's when it was suddenly 4 or 5 of us. And then, and that again surely helped the visibility of Etna. I know that some of them actually drew inspiration from what we had done. We even actually vinified the first 4 vintages of one of these producers at our winery.
Which one?
I don't think I should say
it. Which one wasn't it? No, it's okay. It's okay.
Okay. We have a very different style these days. So, but we did help. We did help to sort of spread the knowledge and culture of how to make wine on Etna. And then there was another wave, for sure, in the mid-2000s, when locals, mostly locals, emerged. So in the early 2000s, it was non-locals that came to Etna. And in the mid-2000s, a few very prominent locals, that like Graci, like Girolamo Russo, like Tenuta di Fessina, even though they are not local, and Pietra Dolce. So there was a core of producers now about 13 years ago. And then... Benanti was named the Italian Winery of the Year by Gambero Rosso Slow Wine in 2007. And I think that really shed new light on Etna. And now, again, it's 160 producers.
It's so interesting that that wave, that sort of first wave after you guys started with Cornelissen and Franchetti and Terre Nere, took 3 very different approaches to the wines of Etna. And maybe you're a fourth approach that's different from the 3 of them as well. In such an old and historic region, but that's also so new, I imagine there's still people trying to figure out what is typical of Etna, what kind of wine should be made here. Have you guys rethought that process for yourself as well?
Well, this is a very, very good question. And I was voted president of the Etna DOC appellation 3 months ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Maybe not, actually.
It's a big job, but that's why I'm flying back to Italy really in a few days. I'm not touring the US as I normally do. And the issue of having a recognizable Etna style is really a big one, and one we want to face. Wine has to, of course, reflect the personality of the producer, but mostly it has to reflect the territory where it's made and the very essence of its grapes. Etna has really grown with a sort of hockey stick growth rate lately, and that also coincided with the maybe the growth as well of the natural wine movement. So currently on Etna we have conventional but artisanal producers like us. You also have a number of natural wine producers. So there's been a lot of diversity suddenly on Etna. We have honed our style through the years. I think we have tried to privilege elegance more and more. Maybe Frank Cornelissen went through a similar process, and Terre Nere has a very clear concept of how to make wine and how they think, you know, the market appreciate Etna wines. Franchetti's wines are very much his own wines. However, they are among my favorites on Etna. They are definitely typical. So we all go down a different route in terms of our own evolution. But yes, it is very important for all of us to make wine on Etna that is really recognizable as an Etna style.
So do you think that the appellation might be a bit too large in order to do that? Because you have, from my understanding, the appellation exists on the north side, the east side, and maybe the south or southeast side of Etna, and then a large amount of altitude variation too. So I imagine there could be, even if you were to take a similar approach from a low altitude south side or a high altitude north side vineyard, you'd have very different outcome.
I think, the short answer is no. I don't think the appellation is too large. Actually, I think that the diversity in what eventually is bottled is usually mostly the result of a different approach, maybe to vinification, because the beauty of Etna is that depending on where you are, you have a unique mix of a number of variables that really determine your microclimate. Like, again, elevation, you have about 2,100 feet range within the appellation. You have different aspects, so different intensity of sunlight, hours of sunlight, rainfall rate, 70 different types of volcanic soils. Ventilation is different. And I think it's nice to show the beauty of this diversity. I think this is it really enriches the wine region. It is true that some areas are more suitable for some grapes and some others for other grapes. That's something we try to reflect in the Benanti approach by having vineyards on four different sites on Etna. There is a debate, there has been a debate actually on expanding the appellation area. Currently, we have planted approximately 900 hectares. If you multiply that by 2.4, you get the acres. I'm not good with numbers, but it's the actual amount of the surface that has vineyards on Etna is about twice this size. But we are not currently thinking of expanding the DOC area. What we do want to do is to maybe find a objective, science-based method of deciding how to approach the issue. But we cannot just lightheartedly do anything about the boundaries of the Etna DOC because it's a very serious topic and maybe it has been brought up too often without really going in enough depth in the analysis. So we in the consortium, we don't see it as a priority. Not at this stage. We, however, want to have the tools, the technical tools and the science-based tools to answer the question and then see what will happen. But it's not a priority at this stage. I think the priority is within the appellation area of which I'm responsible as the president of the DOC, wines must be top quality, recognizable, typical.
Mm-hmm. And in order to define the typicity, we have the indigenous grapes, mm-hmm. right? Are people pushing to include outside grapes?
No. Actually, that has been, by now, it's very clear. And again, maybe I should mention Burgundy and Lange again, where it's very clear that in Lange, you just work with Nebbiolo, and in Burgundy, you do Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, depending on where you are. Etna, by now, is clearly based on Nerello Mascalese and Carricante, and to a smaller extent, Nerello Cappuccio. Mm-hmm. So there is no pressure to include non-indigenous grapes.
It would be interesting to hear, in your words, a little bit about each of these grapes.
Yes. These grapes are, for one thing, they're very much one-zone varieties. Carricante, for example, with really tiny exceptions, really neglectable exceptions, only exists on Mount Etna and historically has been grown mostly on the eastern slope and southern slope of Etna. So it's very boutique. It's really a true ambassador of Etna only. And that is very important for us because the territory is what must stand out. And we are happy that this variety has not spread it that much around the world. Basically, it's non-existent outside Etna. It's a neutral grape It's not a fruity grape. It's not aromatic. It is really based on all the clusters of all the descriptors of the citrus fruit cluster, mostly when it's young. But then as it ages, it will really develop, as you know, because you've tried some back vintages, these very like flinty notes and these petrol notes. It's a very precise, elegant, long finish, acidic variety, clearly dry. And even though volume-wise it accounts for about a quarter of the Etna volumes, it is very representative of the territory Etna, because it, by just having a sip or even just looking at Carricante, very pale color, very delicate sense, it will not remind you of Sicily. It's clearly a mountain wine variety. And in my opinion, the most typical Etna Bianco or Etna Bianco Superiore is 100% Carricante. The two reds, well, there's a clear unbalance. Nerello Mascalese, 75 or even 80% of the Etna vineyards is the building block of Etna, for sure. Again, another pale variety, not very deep in color, and very much based on, in terms of aromas and scents, little red fruit. It's also very acidic, has a lot of precision. Nice tannins that do take a little while to become rounder, but that is one of the main features of Nerello Mascalese. Very age worthy. It can be appreciated young. I think, unlike whites, which I think need a bit of age, Nerello Mascalese can really be appreciated young or aged. 2 days ago, for our 30th anniversary as Benanti, we had a tasting going back to 1998. But at the cellar, we have bottles of Nerello Mascalese, Rovitello, Serra della Contessa, going back even to further back in the past. They still hold very well. Drinking window for an Etna wine is, I think, 20 years, where I can really put my hand on fire. Currently, few wineries can answer that question by opening a bottle, because a few of us were around at that time. But as a bigger number of producers will be able to prove longevity, and the question on longevity of Etna will be answered, I think Etna will step up even further in terms of reputation and positioning, which is already high.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. It's amazing how youthful Carricante can be. It can hold on to its youth for such a long time.
Even a little bit frustrating because it's, you know, you have to release it at some stage, but you just know that it will get so much better after a decade or so.
And on that note, we're going to take just a quick break, and we'll be back with Antonio Benanti of the Benanti Winery in Mount Etna, Sicily, right after this.
This program is brought to you by Jewel Sous Vide. My name is Katie Mosman Wadler. I'm the executive director of HRN and a real-life Jewel user. I use Jewel to help me host the most delicious dinner parties. When you cook with Jewel, there's zero guesswork. So steak, chicken, seafood, turkey, vegetables, and eggs all come out exactly the way you like them. The Paired app is super intuitive and has a great visual doneness guide. Jewel is awesome for prepping many perfect portions, making it easy to cook for a crowd, and it's hands-free so you can focus on entertaining while Jewel does the work. And pro tip, Jewel is also great for travel. I throw mine in my suitcase if I'm headed to a rental house with any kind of uncertain kitchen. From perfect steak to juicy, tender Thanksgiving turkey, Jewel makes the best food you've ever tasted. Just be sure to save some room for mini jars of pumpkin pie. Jewel, perfect food every time. To get yours, visit chefsteps.com/Jewel and use code HRN, as in Heritage Radio Network, to get $15 off for a limited time. That's chefsteps.com/JOULE, code HRN.
Can try.
All right, we're back with Antonio Benanti of Benanti Winery. You know, last night I actually went to one of my favorite local restaurants in Brooklyn with my girlfriend Alyssa, and we drank two of your wines, the Pietra Marina 2013 and the 2001 Etna Rosso.
Rovitello?
The Rovitello, yeah. Yes, out of Magnum. And they were both fantastic. And, you know, we were talking about how Caricante needs some time to age. It really only blossomed at the end of the meal, and yeah. I was like, oh, I wish I could have that open a little bit longer or lay that down in the cellar. And the 2001 was just absolutely gorgeous. It was one of the prettiest wines I've had in some time.
Thank you.
So I'm really excited to see you know, how these wines continue to age, and recommend for all of you listeners to go and check out Locanda Vignaioli. They have some really cool wines there. I did want to ask you quickly about another important person in the history of the winery, with Salvo Foti. Mm-hmm. And I know he left a few years ago, but he's such an important figure in the wines of Etna. Can you talk about how he was a part of the winery and what his role was?
Absolutely. When my father decided to really start up a proper winery in 1988, he didn't know any enologist, and this is almost like a coincidence. My father was having lunch in Castiglione di Sicilia with a friend, a doctor called Francesco Micale, who is still there, and we are still very good friends. And he told him about his idea of starting up a winery. And Francesco Micale said, actually, I know a young enologist who is helping out the Professor Zappalà of the University of Catania. And he seems to be very keen on Etna and a very research-based approach. So a couple of weeks later, my father met Salvo. And Salvo Foti, he's an Etna man. He's from Etna, the province of Catania. But he had never been, he had never had a project, a real project with a vision, with some means. And I would say a positively crazy guy like my father, that could give him a chance. He had consulted for other producers outside Etna, still within Sicily. So my father teamed up with him, and Salvo has been with my father and with the consultants that stayed on and off until 2007, these other consultants. So this technical team has really been, you know, sort of shaping up our style. We started with a research of sampling grapes all around Etna to really understand where to start. And that's what led to the winery being present in Rovitello, Milo, and then Via Grande and Santa Maria di Licodia. So north, east, southeast, and southwest. Very research-based. And Salvo has actually never been a full-time employee, but he has been consulting since 1988 until 2011. In 2004, we hired Enzo Cali, who is our current enologist. So Enzo has been basically worked full-time in the winery since 2004 and executing and supporting Salvo's work until 2011, which and then we promoted Enzo. So we basically had two enologists in 30 years, which I think really helps the continuity in the house style. I think we have slightly changed the style in that we wanted to gain more elegance and we wanted to stay away from smaller oak. But of course, the style was born in the 80s. So Salvo was very instrumental and we were instrumental for him. We are in very good terms. We are almost neighbors in Milo, in terms of vineyards, where we both grow our Carricante. So he is for sure iconic, and he is for sure the one enologist that really understood Etna first and helped to develop it. And my father is for sure, Benanti was the best project to embark on. So we have helped each other for a long time, and then we went separate ways in a very peaceful way, and we're friends. So for sure, they teamed up very well, my father and him.
Sounds like it was mutually beneficial.
Absolutely, yeah. Mutually beneficial, yes.
And something that Salvo is a big proponent of is the bush train vines.
Yes.
It's something that's very unique to Mount Etna. Obviously, they exist in other places in the world, but not nearly as much as, you know, on Etna. And I was wondering if you could talk about how much do you guys use bush train vines? Is that part of Benanti's vineyard holdings?
Yes, absolutely. Most of our vineyards are head train bush vines on Etna.
Yeah, so I said it incorrectly. Yeah,
it's my WSET studies. Nice. The system was brought by the Greek to Etna, and then the Romans improved it by giving it more geometry. Mm-hmm. It's for sure the historical and traditional way of training vines on Etna for mainly two reasons. First, to make the best use of sometimes very small spaces and small terraces. If you chose another system, you would really not be using your surface in the optimal way. And also, it's the one that can maximize the density and therefore the competition among vines, and to therefore sort of tame the productivity of your vineyard together with pruning. So eventually, for a quality and excellence-oriented producer, the Alberello or the head train bush vines is for sure the most popular, traditional, and I think effective way. So even in our case, most of our vineyards and the vineyards of all our most important wines are Alberello, so bush vines.
And you say Nerello Mascalese is a more productive grape, or is it so it helps to naturally?
Carricante is rather productive, and Nerello as well. Of course, we all the Etna appellation sets a maximum threshold in terms of production, so there's a yield above which you cannot go. But even those, we never come close to those. They're actually, I think, there could be some room for reducing them even further, mm-hmm. which is one of the things we have in mind as an idea that we will discuss when I'm back. Etna is really about low yields and short pruning, and it will never be a volume-driven wine industry, even now that the number of producers is growing and there are more hectares planted. Etna will always still be a niche, and I think that if occasionally somebody wants to take a different approach, I think it would not be beneficial for Etna. Etna is premium, it's boutique, and it's small volumes.
And are all of the Alberello vines ungrafted as well? Or?
No, they're not all ungrafted. I mean, Phylloxera spared a very large portion of Etna, and I think it's very safe on Etna even not to graft and currently plant ungrafted vines for safety reasons, just as a precaution, but also as a way of, again, sort of, the rootstock can also be a way of keeping your productivity and your vigor under control. So we have very old ungrafted vines for the Serra della Contessa and the Rovitello and part of the Pietra Marina vineyards. And we've been grafting the new vines for the newer newer plantings. But you will find on Etna a large portion of ungrafted and sometimes pre-phylloxera vineyards, which we have taken for granted for many years until we then found out that it was something so unique. The thing is, we have always been surrounded by these old vines on Etna. So we only discovered later by traveling and talking to professionals like you how special it was. But on Etna, actually, you will see quite a good portion of them.
Yeah, it's really exciting for wine professionals and wine lovers, I think. I don't know if this is just something that's romantic, or, but I've always felt that maybe in some way having an ungrafted vine is in some way a fuller representation. You're not introducing something foreign to it, and it's so rare to be able to find places where that's even a possibility. So one of the things that makes Aetna so special.
Yes, that is true, Joe. However, it is also very difficult, I think, to really single out the benefit of having an ungrafted vines. Some people can claim that they can tell the difference, in tasting a wine from a grafted or an ungrafted vine. I really think it's very hard. There's a lot of romance. I think it mostly has to do with, it's a proof of how deeply rooted a certain wine culture is in a certain territory, mm-hmm. like Aetna. I think you mentioned the word romantic. I think there's a lot of that, and there's probably some science based, or maybe I'm just not aware of the science behind it. But I have lately we have received a very prominent grapevine nursery owner called Pierre-Marie Guillaume, who we've been working with for 30 years, and he told me how he's consulting Romane Conti. And how Romane Conti, every 15 years, they replant a third of their vineyards, because they believe that what is really essential is the actual genetic material and a certain muscle selection, as opposed to the age of the vine itself. So I think the wine world will constantly have this debate. And it's very difficult to give black or white, mm-hmm. clear-cut answers in that respect.
Interesting. A few years back, you and your brother took over.
Yes.
Your father's still around, but can you tell us about about how that sort of went down? How did that happen that you decided to sort of upend your lives? I know you were not working at the winery and take over the winery.
Yeah. Yes. The winery was started when I have a twin brother, Salvino. We were 14 years old in 1988 when the winery was started. And that was the time when actually my father sent us abroad for many years. So we've been abroad, both my brother and I, for almost 15 years. So despite that, we have attended every single Vinitaly wine fair in Verona since the very first one that Benanti attended in 1993. So we've been exposed to the wine world while we were doing something else for many years. And then we came back for good in the first half of the years 2000, working in a different field, which was mostly pharmaceuticals, because our family was also running that as a main business that really paid for the wine venture for many years. In that, not so much the wine, basically my father's proceeds from that were all invested in the winery. In the 6 years ago, given that my father is now 73 and he was showing a little bit of, I think, tiredness, my brother and I realized that this is the kind of venture when your name is on the bottle. Aetna is really growing. The outlook is fantastic, but it needs a full-time commitment. So we had both already qualified as sommeliers early in the years 2000. So we both had the idea of joining at some stage. But it's really 6 years ago when we both decided to join. I decided that a few weeks before my brother, then I persuaded him as well. Literally a month later. And so since the late 2012, we are fully in charge. I am the sole administrator, and my brother is technically an employee, but we are on board together. And the learning curve was very steep, because one thing is very different to be fully in charge than seeing it from the outside. Mm-hmm. And we have brought about many changes in terms of...
It seems like you had a pretty clear vision as to what you wanted to do immediately.
Yeah, I think, Joe, that sometimes it's easier to have a clear idea when you look at it from the outside mm-hmm. rather than when you're part of it. So we have decided to, again, really back Enzo Cali, our enologist, Enzo Cali's ideas, which are very similar to our own ideas. And we decided to do a bit of divestments of vineyards, new investments in vineyards. We invested heavily in the storage, in the warehousing of wine, because we really care about wine is stored. So that is very important. We upgraded the facilities and we have expanded the winery on a more international scale. We have given a new face to the winery because when you have very important characters like my father, Giuseppe Benanti, or Salvo Foti, that had been there for many years, you're at risk of maybe being too related to those figures, whereas a winery and any venture must go on, and especially when the bottles bear your name and the outside world, I'm saying it in a very humble way, but the outside world wants to know who's next. So we understood how important it was to really show our face. We visited every single market in which we sell wine to introduce ourselves and to build our own connections. We have replaced a number of distributors and we have just reassured or proven to the outside world that Benanti is there regardless of who is in charge in a way, or at least that the second generation was as focused or even more focused and as committed as the first, which is very important, and a number of producers on Etna will have to go through that stage mm-hmm. in the future. We passed that point, and it's very reassuring. I look back, and I've seen how hard it has been in the last 6 years, but I know that now the whole world is aware of, you know, our ideas, our view, and the succession, and, you know, this transition is no longer an issue for the outside world. We are who we are, and we'll keep going.
And you mentioned that you had divested in some of the vineyards. I know that you sold vineyards that were Nero d'Avola and got rid of the non-indigenous grapes and really reinvested in Mount Etna. I think that's very commendable. I'm happy to see that you did that. Were there any decisions that you made after you took over that were a fight with your father? Did you say, you know what, I would never have done that. I can't believe you've done this.
My father, let's not forget it. My father has been operating through the 90s and the 2000 when there's so many questions on Etna had to be answered and so much still had to be found out. So he has been experimenting with again, the core has always been the indigenous grapes, but he also decided with Salvo to experiment with non-indigenous to really single out the Etna effect on well-known grapes as a way of understanding Etna better. So, but of course, in the more modern and contemporary Etna, those wines that have been so useful in understanding what Etna brings to a grape were no longer made any sense. But my father had come up with the names and the paintings on the bottles, and he had planted the vineyard, so he was very emotionally attached to those. So for a number of years, and even if just one person says, hey, why are you no longer making that one wine? He will still be upset. But I think overall he's very happy with what we have done. And again, in wine you must be a specialist, you must be fully focused. And so we went at some stage in the vineyard, in the winery, we had more than 15 grape varieties, given this experimental work that has served a lot for knowledge of Etna, not only for us, but for all those that learned about Etna. But again, they were wines for a different era. They were no longer made sense here. We do have some bottles that we open sometimes, but I think what we have done is makes perfect sense, and my father really agrees and is very happy about what we have done.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Antonio. It's been such a pleasure to have you on. I am very excited to see what the future holds for Benanti. The quality is already so high, and I'm so excited to see the improvements that you guys will continue to make. So I really appreciate having you on the show.
Thank you very much, Joe. It's been a big, big pleasure. And you will see some news from us because we have a few wines, some few new wines in very small quantities that will come. So watch this space. And thank you. Thank you again for having me.
And you can come drink the Benanti wines at Fausto. I'd love to see you there. I wanted to thank our listeners for joining in for another week. If you like In the Drink and want to help out, please rate and review and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. I also want to thank our engineer this week, first time, Jeet Paul. Thanks, Jeet. Really appreciate it. And our producer, Jessamine Molly, and Renny Lopez, who did the theme music. Hope to see you guys at Fausto. And until next time, thanks for listening to In the Drink.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.